From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. She died yesterday at the age of 84. She led the Post through its transformation from a mediocre paper to a major force in the political life of Washington and America. She published the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate investigation in spite of government pressure to back down. We'll listen back to a 1997 interview with her. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of Woody Herman's Columbia recordings from 1945 to 47. And language commentator Jeff Nunberg explains how in corporate speak, a solution no longer has to be attached to a problem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush meets with the leaders of the G8 countries at a summit that begins Friday in the northern Italian port of Genoa. He arrived tonight in Britain for a brief stay in advance of the Industrialized Nations session. From London, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
President Bush begins his second trip to Europe this summer with a stopover in the country widely regarded as the least critical of Washington's allies. Mr. Bush has upset many European capitals with plans to proceed apace with the missile defense shield and to abandon the Kyoto Accord on global warming. But while Britain's leader has not embraced the Bush agenda, he's not dismissed it out of hand either. Tony Blair has expressed his understanding for U.S. positions without necessarily agreeing with them. Mr. Bush's first state visit to Britain will play up historic Anglo-American ties. The president pays a visit to Winston Churchill's underground war rooms, lunches with the Queen at Buckingham Palace, and holds talks with Tony Blair at his country retreat. The two men travel Friday to the Genoa summit. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
The Senate today considered legislation to cut greenhouse gas emissions blamed for global warming. But the Senate plan does not propose mandatory carbon dioxide cuts like those detailed in the Kyoto Protocol. President Bush pulled the United States out of the Kyoto negotiations in March, saying the treaty would harm the American economy. The General Accounting Office today demanded that Vice President Dick Cheney identify all the industry leaders who helped formulate the Bush administration's energy policy. If he refuses, there could be a court fight. The GAO action follows repeated refusals by the Vice President's office to provide names and titles of participants who met with the Energy Task Force chaired by Cheney. The result was an energy policy that includes expanded oil and gas drilling on public land and a rejuvenated nuclear power system. New research suggests that Teflon, when heated to high temperatures, produces a chemical that lives indefinitely in the environment, but there's no evidence the substance is harmful to humans. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The chemical is called trifluoroacetic acid, or TFA. It seems to hang around forever. Minute amounts of TFA, parts per billion or less, have been found in rainwater. Researchers report in the journal Nature that they may have found its major source, a class of materials called fluoropolymers, which includes Teflon. The researchers heated nonstick pans to over 600 degrees Fahrenheit and found they produced TFA. This is probably not happening very much in the kitchen, but it does occur in industrial applications. The researchers and the DuPont company who make Teflon say this is no reason to stop using these materials. The idea of an immortal chemical does make some environmental researchers nervous. TFA seems not to harm people, but in large doses can kill some types of algae. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow fell 36 points today on Wall Street, and the Nasdaq was off 51. This is NPR News. Fed Chief Alan Greenspan suggests more interest rate cuts may be on the way. Greenspan told a House panel the year-long economic slowdown is not over yet, despite six interest rate cuts so far this year. He says the economy may, in his words, require further policy response. That could be interpreted to mean another rate cut might be in order. Coast Guard investigators have located the sunken fishing vessel Arctic Rose in the Bering Sea. From member station KPLU in Seattle, Jason DeRose reports.
Investigators used a sonar device to locate the sunken boat 200 miles northwest of St. Paul Island in the Bering Sea. Coast Guard officials then viewed the wreckage with a camera mounted on a robotic submarine. A short memorial ceremony involving the dropping of a wreath over the Arctic Rose also took place. The Seattle-based vessel was part of the North Pacific Fishing Fleet and went down April 2nd with no warning. High seas and 40-knot winds on the Bering Sea are believed to have contributed to the loss of the ship and its crew of 15. Little debris was found near the location of the tragedy, only an empty life raft and 6 unused thermal survival suits. The deaths of the Arctic Rose crew were the nation's worst commercial fishing disaster in 50 years. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Seattle.
Thousands of NATO troops launched a training exercise today in eastern Bosnia. The maneuvers were held where the UN War Crimes Tribunal's 2 most wanted suspects are believed to be hiding. Officially, the exercise has nothing to do with the hunt for former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and his wartime military leader General Ratko Mladic, but reportedly it's raised expectations the 2 fugitives may soon be brought into custody. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember Katharine Graham, the former president and publisher of The Washington Post. She died yesterday at the age of 84 after sustaining a severe head injury from a fall on a sidewalk. She took over the Post in 1963, a time when newspaper women were pretty much confined to the women's pages. She led the Post through its transformation from a mediocre paper into a major force in the political life of Washington and the nation. She gave the go-ahead on the publication of the Pentagon Papers and kept reporters on the Watergate story in spite of White House pressure. Before she retired in 1993, she was sometimes called the Iron Lady, but her Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Personal History, revealed the insecurities beneath the surface. The Post was a family-owned paper. Graham unexpectedly inherited the position of publisher when her husband, Philip Graham, committed suicide in 1963. He had taken over the paper from Katharine Graham's father when he retired. Her father made his fortune on Wall Street. He purchased the Post in 1933 when she was in high school. In 1997, after the publication of Katharine Graham's memoir, I asked what her reaction was when her father bought the Post.
I was very excited. I'd had a previous interest in journalism. I had even gone on the school paper before he bought the Post. And it whetted my interest, obviously. And I was excited. Of course, it wasn't like it is today. It was one of 5 newspapers. It was 5th in a field of 5, and it had a circulation of 50,000. And it was in a really run-down old building on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so although it was thrilling, it wasn't like it would be today.
In 1940... you got married to Philip Graham, who you describe in your memoirs having a beautiful mix of intellectual, physical, and social charm, and that he was warm and funny on top of that. When your husband was 30, your father made him the associate publisher of the Post, and your husband virtually became your father's deputy. How did you feel about your husband going into journalism and going into the family business?
I was thrilled and loved it. I loved Washington. I loved the paper. we had discussed when he went in the Army, my father said, "Are you interested?" Because he was having a terrible struggle making the paper pay, making it viable. And he said, "I don't want to go through this unless there's some future for the paper. Are you interested?" And my brother was a psychiatrist and nobody thought of women's ever managing anything. And I said, "It's up to you. I don't want to try to influence you because it's you who are going to have to do it and it's your life." He had planned to go into law and politics in Florida where he came from. And so he thought about it a long time and we talked about it a long time. And finally he agreed that after the war was over, he would come write on the paper. And that's what he did. I loved it.
Now, in 1948, when you were 31, your father decided to pass the paper on to you and your husband, but he gave your husband, I think, nearly 3 times more shares than he gave you. How did you feel about that inequity? After all, you were the direct descendant of the Washington Post family.
I had no reservations about it. My father said, I'm doing this because I think no man should work for his wife. Obviously a sexist view of things, but not unusual in those days. And I had no problem with it. I thought it was okay.
Now, you describe your husband as using the Washington Post to right wrongs that you now think is inappropriate for journalism. Give us an example of how he used the paper to change things as opposed to just reporting on what happened.
The first thing he tried to change was the city itself. He was very instrumental in the redevelopment of Southwest Washington, and he certainly had it covered by reporters more than normally would have been. More importantly and more negatively for the paper, he got involved with future president, then majority leader Lyndon Johnson, and he was enamored with Johnson, and he really used the paper to support Johnson. Most importantly, for instance, during the civil rights battle, we were for home rule and civil rights and all that sort of thing. He influenced the coverage of a riot that occurred about opening a swimming pool. And Ben Bradley had covered it, and he was indignant. And my husband said, Buster, come on up and come to my office. I want you to see what's going on. And in his office, he had Oscar Chapman, then Secretary of the Interior, and he had Clark Clifford, who was then in the White House. And he had a lot of people. And he made a deal with them. If the Post downplayed that story, they would open the swimming pools next year. Now, that was a positive act, but it was involving the paper in an active way that really shouldn't be done. I mean, you should report what is going on instead of using it to deal with the government.
What was at issue here, I think, was that the swimming pool was segregated and your husband wanted it to be integrated.
Of course, right.
And
which was a worthwhile goal, mm-hmm. but which he really committed the error of downplaying the news in order to make the deal about their opening the swimming pool next for the following summer.
You write that as your husband got more power in Washington, he also developed a drinking problem and the symptoms of manic depression. As for yourself, you write, despite my pleasure in the life I was leading during those years, I can see now that I was having problems I didn't acknowledge to myself. I was growing shyer and less confident as I got older. I still didn't know how to look my best or how to handle myself in social situations. I was afraid of being boring and went on believing that people related to us entirely because of my husband. As for him, at the same time that he was building me up, he was tearing me down. As he emerged on the journalistic and political scenes, I increasingly saw my role as the tail to his kite. And the more I felt overshadowed, the more it became a reality. When did you realize this, the sense that you were becoming more insecure and more overshadowed by your husband?
I only realized that in retrospect. Two or three close friends, when I went to them at the time that he left the house and went off with a young woman from Newsweek, said to me, good. And I said, good? How can you say that? It's just devastating. It's awful. And they said, don't you realize what he's doing to you, that you're the butt of the family jokes? And I said, no, I don't think that's right, and I really am distraught. So it shook me up that they viewed it that way, but I realized really many years afterwards that probably that was right.
What was happening in your life that made you feel increasingly insecure and insubordinate?
I was intimidated by him to the point where I didn't talk when we went out. I just let him talk. And sometimes if I did talk, or he would look at me as if I were going on too long. And it was that kind of thing that really made me think, gee, I must be boring. and I guess led to my silence.
You write that as your husband's behavior grew more erratic with his manic depression and he had an affair, he left you and then decided to buy back your stock within the Washington Post and take over the paper with his new lover. And in spite of your lack of confidence, you decided you were going to fight to hold on to the paper. How did you decide, given your insecurity at that time, to fight to hold on to it?
Because I first didn't, you know, I knew he was ill, and when he left, I thought, oh, well, he's ill. And finally, I realized that this was real, and he was going to lawyers, and he wanted a divorce, and that he was going to take the paper with him. And I thought, well, I can't help what he's doing, but I can fight to keep the paper, and I'm going to. I mean, if he wanted a divorce, I was going to go into court. And the reason I think I thought I could do this was I knew that the paper had been built up with my father. I knew my father had supported Phil. I knew that I had, in my own way, supported Phil. And I thought he was great and that he had added greatly to the paper. But I had participated in the buildup through my father's earliest years and struggles, and year after year, discouragement because they kept losing money. And all that made me emotional about the paper. I loved the paper, and I just wasn't going to give up. I didn't think particularly how I would do it. I just was going to dig in.
What did your family think? Did they think that you should hold on to the paper because after all, you were the blood member of the family? Or did they feel that, well, you were the woman and even if you were divorcing, it would be better off in the man's hands?
No. Nobody thought that. My father had already died when this happened, but my mother was alive and supported me absolutely and said, you know, we've got to hold on to the paper. And so did all my friends and associates.
Then your husband came back to you, but one day after saying he was going to lie down, he went to the bedroom and shot himself. You heard the gun go off and found him dead. Did you ever think he would go that far, that his manic depression had gotten that severe?
No, and he was very deceptive. He told us all that he was feeling better, and he seemed to be feeling better. He'd been in a mental hospital and had gotten the day off. And I was deceived, and the hospital was deceived into thinking he was better than he was. And as I hear is mostly the case, he had talked a lot about suicide when he was ill, but never done it. And he wasn't talking about suicide at the time that he clearly had it on his mind. I think that happens.
Did he talk about suicide with you or just with other people?
He did with me earlier in the years when he was depressed.
We're listening back to an interview with the late Catherine Graham, former publisher of The Washington Post. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to a 1997 interview with Catherine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. She died yesterday at the age of 84. After your husband's suicide, you were, as you write, pushed into a new and unknown life. What did you initially think you were going to do?
I thought I was going to work because I now owned the controlling shares of the company in the paper. And I thought I therefore had the responsibility to learn what made it happen and what made it tick, and that I would go to work solely to learn. That's the way I viewed it.
As opposed to actually take control.
Yes, I thought that there was a man who was chairman of the board, Fritz Beebe, and my husband had brought him on just about a year or two before he died. And he was wonderful, and he wanted me to go to work. And there were a lot of men running the divisions and the editors. And I thought, fine, this will just go on the way it is, and I can learn.
One of your colleagues, a man, said to you, You're not going to work, are you? You mustn't. You're young and attractive, and you'll get remarried. Did you think, well, maybe that's what I should be doing. I should, you know, just get remarried, start a new family life at home.
And no, that was said by a friend, not a colleague, Chip Boland, who was in the Foreign Service then and was a distinguished diplomat. And I saw him abroad just before I came home and went to work, and that's what he said. And I said, of course I'm going to work. And it didn't occur to me, in fact, that there was any conflict with getting married if I wanted to. I didn't really think. But in fact, it was so totally demanding that I probably couldn't have gotten remarried, but I didn't think about it.
You write that early on, after taking over the post, you were encumbered by a deep feeling of uncertainty and inferiority and a need to please and to be liked. You say, I was unable to make a decision that might displease those around me. How did that affect your decision-making early on and your interactions with the staff?
Oh, it got in my way a lot, but it's a very lot of, it tends to be female baggage, and it still is to some extent. But it was much worse then. The way it affected my performance is that I couldn't say, I've listened to everybody, and now I think we ought to do this. I had to get everybody to agree to whatever it was. And if everybody didn't agree, I'd go around begging them to see my point of view. And it was just a very poor way to be a leader.
Suddenly, your social circle expanded. But that circle was really pretty similar to the one you'd had before with your husband. But now, instead of being the wife, you were the publisher in that circle. How did that change your behavior in that circle? And was there an uncomfortable transition?
I think it was very gradual, because I was used to the people I was relating to. But my profile obviously grew with experience and with time in the job. And I suppose it rose considerably for a bizarre reason, which is that Truman Capote in 1966 gave the black and white ball in my honor. And so suddenly this was written about, and it was a big event, and it was covered. And it was really the beginning of my knowing those people who were at the ball. I didn't know them before that, and they certainly didn't know me.
What was the difference between how you acted within this larger social circle when you were seeing yourself as, like, the wife of the publisher of the Post compared to how you handled yourself when you became the publisher yourself?
It's hard to really think back to that. I just gradually grew used to it, and I realized that I was going to be conspicuous because I had the job I had. At one point, I was at my friend Joe Alsop's for dinner, and I had been used to the women and the men parting company after Washington dinners. While the men talked about issues and the women went and powdered their nose and discussed their households. And at one point, I suddenly realized that I'd been working all day, that I'd been involved in an editorial lunch with somebody who was in the news, and that I'd been working, and that now I was being asked to go in the other room with the wives. And I said to Joe, who was a good friend, I hope you won't mind if I slip out of here because the paper comes, and I really can use the time better than going in that room with the wives. And he said, oh, darling, you can't do that. And I said, sure I can. I mean, it's just, I don't want to use my time like that, Joe. And so he was so upset that he made me stay, and he broke up the segregation. And then it broke up all over Washington. So that was an instance where I guess suddenly I realized that I was in the working world and that I didn't have to do those things.
When you took over the Post, there were few women in journalism and far fewer women in the kind of upper position that you held. You say that early on you didn't realize that part of what you were experiencing was emblematic of the larger issues in the women's movement. What made you realize that your life really connected to the issues of the women's movement?
Two things. One is simply experience in the workplace and being talked to by women and issues coming up, such as really little issues, but they were symbolic. There's a big newspaper dinner, and no women had ever been invited, called the Gridiron in Washington. And I was invited as a guest. And the women rose up in the paper and wrote me and said, please don't go until there's a woman member. And at first I was startled and said, you know, I was rather thrilled to go, and after all, it was a gesture toward opening up. And they said, no, you know, until there's a member, don't please go. And we feel very strongly about this. And so I didn't. And, of course, it made me aware of those issues. But the other thing that was as important, if not more so, was the rise of the women's movement. In particular, I became a friend of Gloria Steinem, and she argued with me about women's positions and how I should understand them. And at first I said, oh, Gloria, you know that's not for me. And she said, yes, it is. If you understand what this is about, it will make your life better, and it will make other people's lives better around you. And she was right. So those two things, experience and Gloria.
Okay, so when you realized that Steinem was right and you more personally and intellectually connected to the women's movement, how did that change you personally and change the way you managed the post?
I think it made you certainly more aware of women's problems in the workplace and of the need to get more women in the workplace. It made me more aware of bias in the news, such as somebody being described as a 58-year-old gray-haired grandmother. And I realized that I had to do something and try to make things better in the company. I didn't always succeed because I didn't quite know how to go about it in some cases. I didn't know how to lean on people who were doing a wonderful job but who were blatant male chauvinists and make them understand the issues. But little by little, we made progress, and some of it was due to being sued.
The Post was sued.
Newsweek was sued, the stations were sued,
mm-hmm.
and the Post.
Catherine Graham recorded in 1997 after the publication of her Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir. She died yesterday at the age of 84. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with the late Catherine Graham, former publisher of The Washington Post. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of Woody Herman's recordings from the mid-40s. And language commentator Jeff Nunberg considers one of the latest developments in the language of corporate marketing.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1997 interview with Katharine Graham. She died yesterday at the age of 84. Graham was the publisher of the Washington Post from 1963 to 93. Her father bought the paper when she was in high school. When he retired, her husband became the publisher. After living in her husband's shadow, she felt unprepared to take over the paper after his suicide in 1963. On top of that, she had to assert her authority at a time when few women were in positions of authority. But it took a while for her to connect to the larger issues of the women's movement and to realize that women at the Post weren't getting a fair shake. Did you ever confront a man about his chauvinism on the job?
Yes. I wrote a note once that I found in the files in which somebody, a personnel director, had circulated a memo, and he had referred to the men as Brown, Smith, and Jones, and it was the women were Mary, Sue, and Margaret. And I said, wait a minute here. Why are we referred to by our first name and the other guys are last names? Another instance in which the issue arose was that I recommended a woman to be back of the book editor at Newsweek. And the editors just said, that's impossible. We can't do that. And I must say, I mean, we work long hours, we work weekends, we're here at night. And I stupidly accepted this. And then finally, we were sued by the women at Newsweek. And the editor and Frederick Beebe called me up, and I was on vacation, and said, the women are suing us, and this is very serious. And I said, whose side am I supposed to be on? And Fritz Beebe, my colleague, whom I really loved and respected, said, this isn't funny. And I said, I know it isn't funny, and I'm serious. And on the other hand, as a manager, it bothered me, and I got offended by these suits, but they were right.
The suits were right.
The suits were right, and we did make a lot of progress everywhere as a result, and also as a result of people understanding.
You made Ben Bradlee the managing editor of the Washington Post, a move probably no one would dispute was a smart move. He became a very close working partner of yours, and you had a long and I think very gratifying working relationship with him. How did you decide to make him managing editor?
Little by little, I realized from things that happened, like people applying to be editor, or my friend Scotty Reston of the New York Times said, don't you want to hand on a better paper to your children than you inherited? And on the job, I realized that there was discontent in the city room and that things were not going as well as they should have been. And all this dawned on me gradually. And so I began thinking about it. And by accident, Ben Bradlee had been, he was then bureau chief of Newsweek in Washington, and he had been offered two or three jobs to go to New York and get on the ladder and be one of the principal editors at Newsweek. And he turned them down, I think, first of all, because between him and his wife, they had six children, and he liked Washington, and he didn't move. And I thought, well, I better go talk to Ben, because I didn't really know him very well, but I had heard great things about how he was running the bureau and how he was attracting talent and how the bureau was good. And so I asked him to lunch, and I took him to a club because I'd never asked a man to lunch. And I didn't want to pay the bill. It's really funny. And so we went to a club I belonged to. And I said, what is it that you do want to do? I notice you've turned these jobs down in New York. And, of course, Ben being Ben said, well, now that you ask me, I'd give my left one to be managing editor of the Post. And now that's a little bit vulgar, but Ben talks like that. And I was really brought up short because I didn't expect that. And the managing editor of the Post was an old-timer, had been very loyal, and was a personal friend. And so I said, that's not possible in the near future, maybe someday. And then Ben began pushing, and I'd run into him and he'd say, now, when are we going to talk? And I'd say, Ben, let's cool it. And it's too quick. And Ben kept pushing. And finally, first of all, I sort of resented it and wondered why, since he didn't have the job, he had the nerve to be so pushy. And thinking it over, I thought, well, maybe that kind of energy and that kind of drive is what we need. And so I checked up on him with people like Walter Lippmann and the people at Newsweek and asked everybody what they thought. And they all thought that was a great idea. And so eventually I persuaded the editors to bring him over as an assistant editor. They at first said, oh, fine, he can come on as a reporter like everybody else. And I said, no, I think this is needed in management. And finally he came over, and that's began the process of his succeeding the editor.
One of the defining moments in your career in journalism and in the life of the Washington Post is when you and Ben Bradley decided to publish the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of the war in Vietnam. And Ben Bradley was saying, publish it and publish it quickly. But your lawyers were saying, wait, don't publish it so quickly. In fact, maybe you shouldn't publish it at all. So either take your time or don't do it, but don't rush into it. How did you make up your mind, being in between your lawyers and Bradley and knowing that this was going to be a really important decision?
It was, I had to do it very quickly, in about a minute, because the editors and the head of the company, Fritz Beebe, were at Ben's house, and they were writing, trying to keep it secret. And the lawyers were there, and they were saying it was very dangerous, and indeed we shouldn't publish, because the Times had been enjoined already from publishing by the government, who had taken them to court. And we were in the process of going public. We had announced our plans and not sold the stock, so we were particularly liable to any kind of criminal prosecution from the government. So finally, they called me up because it got so late and the argument got so tense and said, you're going to have to decide this. And I said, well, why do we have to do it right away? The Times took 3 months. And the editors all got on the phone and the business people were on the other phone saying, wait a day. The editors were saying, we mustn't wait a day. Everybody knows we have these papers. And we have to maintain the momentum that was stopped when the Times was enjoined. And it's very important. People have their eyes on us. And we have to publish. And so I listened to them. And finally, after talking to both sides, I asked my colleague Fritz Beebe what he would do when he was a lawyer. And he said, I guess I would not. And that made it hard but not impossible. He said it in such a way that I thought, he's leaving it up to me, and I can do this. And so I said, let's go, let's publish. And I hung up because I was so freaked out by having had to make that decision so fast.
You built up a lot of animosity from the White House toward the Washington Post through publishing the Pentagon Papers and then breaking the Watergate story. And you say in the book, bearing the full brunt of presidential wrath is always disturbing. Now, you have told us about how insecure you were, the kind of low self-esteem you had as a professional when you took over the Post. And here you are now being criticized by the White House. Did you feel personally able to deal with that kind of criticism?
It was pretty scary, and you had to deal with it. Some people have referred to that as courageous, and I didn't view it as courageous. I viewed it as we had no choice. I think courage is when you have a choice and you choose to be courageous. I thought we had no choice once we got in the Watergate reporting. In the Pentagon Papers, that's true. We did have a choice for about a minute. In Watergate, it was like wading into a river. By the time you realized how serious it was, which was several months into the story, we were into it up to our waists, and there was no way you could go back. You had to go forward. And so I simply had to live with it. I was very anxious. I lay about a foot above the bed, worrying at night. But I also didn't think we had any choice except to proceed and to back the editors and reporters in whom I believed.
Were you worried that one day you'd find out that you were being misled, that you were set up, you were the victim of some kind of scam.
Indeed I was. I used to go down and talk to Ben and Howard Simons, the managing editor, all the time, and ask, are we being fair? Are we being accurate? And are we being set up or misled so that our heads can be chopped off? And they had good answers to these, and they were really reassuring. I don't think they were as assured themselves as inwardly as they seemed to be to me. But they said that some of our sources were Republican, and that because we had the story to ourselves, that Woodward and Bernstein had time to check, and that they often withdrew a story by themselves unless they were... And they had two sources for everything. And thirdly, that Woodward had a source, particular source, to whom he went when he was really bothered and puzzled, and that this source had never misled him. And, of course, the source was later christened by the managing editor, Howard Simons, Deep Throat. I still don't know who Deep Throat was. I didn't know then, and I don't know now.
Are you glad you don't know so other people can't try to get it out of you?
Well, I said to Woodward at one point, we met over lunch, and I turned to him and said, who is Deep Throat? And he looked pale and flinched, and I said, oh, it's all right. I don't want the responsibility. You don't have to tell me. He says that he would have told me if I'd asked for it, but I didn't ask for it, and I still don't.
We're listening back to an interview with the late Katharine Graham, former publisher of The Washington Post. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post, died yesterday at the age of 84. We're listening to a 1997 interview recorded after the publication of her memoir. You're turning 80 this year.
Yes.
And in your memoir, you write that turning 70 was actually very difficult.
It's true. I think certain birthdays bother you more than others. 50 didn't bother me much. 60 did. 70 did. 80 doesn't.
Why doesn't 80? 70 did, but 80 doesn't.
I think that at 70, I thought, oh, gee, I guess I'm an old woman. And I've come to terms with that. You know, when we're young, you never think you're going to be old. And you saw, in my day, you saw people with white hair and buns on their head and little old ladies. And I thought, I'm never going to be like that. I mean, I didn't even think about it. I just thought you were young forever. And so to realize that I'd turned 70, I really wanted not to broadcast it. And I went on a trip with some friends out to the West Coast to avoid any observation of it. But my daughter and my children said, well, we want to give a party. And I said, oh, all right, if it's a little party. And, you know, I don't want a lot of people. I don't want people to know I'm 70. And they got the bit in their teeth, and they gave a small party for 600 people, which was widely covered. So this was not a secret from the world.
And your thoughts on turning 80 now?
It's hard because you worry about getting not to be your best. I've been very lucky. I've been able to keep up tennis and keep up movement, and I've been very healthy. And I worry that you might decline or that you might not be able to keep up the life you've lived. But I'm very determined to try to keep going, keep interested, keep involved, and keep learning. I think all that's very important.
You've just completed your memoirs, and I'd like to know what surprises you most about your life and who you became.
Well, looking back on it was really interesting, and I liked it. I think this thing that surprised me the most was the role my father played in my growing up. He was very shy and reticent and not very articulate. So I didn't realize until I reread his letters and mine to him how loving and supportive and important he was to my life. I think that's the biggest discovery I made. And I really, really was moved by this.
Katharine Graham recorded in 1997. She died yesterday at the age of 84. Before World War II, clarinetist Woody Herman led a big band known for playing the blues. After the war, Herman revamped his sound using younger soloists like saxophonist Flip Phillips and Stan Getz, and modern arrangers like Ralph Burns, Neil Hefti, and Shorty Rogers. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Herman couldn't quite shake off his swing-era roots, not that there's anything wrong with that. Kevin reviews a new anthology of Woody Herman recorded in 1945 through 47.
Clarinetist Woody Herman with his First Heard, 1945. Unlike some leaders, Herman was no control freak. He often let his players work out their own background riffs, like Count Basie, for example. That worked for Basie because his crew pulled together. By comparison, Herman's band was a tug of war. The younger guys edged toward the new music of bebop. Herman wanted the band to sound more like Duke Ellington's. Not a bad idea, but not exactly the latest trend as the swing era waned. Herman even drafted drummer Dave Tough, who'd come up playing Chicago-style Dixieland in the 1920s. In theory, it shouldn't have worked. But Tough and modern bassist Chubby Jackson hooked up right away to kick along good soloists like trumpeter Sonny Berman and trombonist Bill Harris. Woody Herman's ambition paid off. His fans included Igor Stravinsky, who at Herman's invitation wrote the band the 8.5-minute Ebony Concerto in 1946. Stravinsky apparently assumed Herman's men were all good readers, and Herman apparently assumed Stravinsky would write something close to their own rhythmic idiom. Two false assumptions. Herman liked the concerto, though he later said, "We had no more right to play it than the man in the moon had." If Ebony Concerto was stuck somewhere between jazz and classical music, Herman's 1947 band, his second Heard, wobbled more agreeably between swing and bebop. By then, Dave Tough was gone, and new drummer Don Lamond was trying to get the hang of bebop's unpredictable accents. He could try too hard sometimes, but his heavy bombs had their own awkward charm. This music comes from Woody Herman's Blowing Up a Storm, the Columbia years, 1945 to 1947. Much as Herman's Herds could zigzag stylistically, the music they made holds up. In this two-disc set, 10 alternate versions of Herman classics are included along with the master takes. 7 of those alternates are out for the first time, a way to tempt Herman fanatics who already have everything else. Of special interest is a second take of Ralph Burns's Summer Sequence, Part 4. It's an elaborate frame for a too-short tenor saxophone solo by Stan Getz. An exhaustive survey of Woody Herman's Columbia years is long overdue. This new set isn't quite it. I miss some tunes that didn't make the cut, like John Laporta's rave-up Non-Alcoholic, P.S. I Love You, featuring singer Marianne McCall, and a manic take on Cacciatorian's Saber Dance. They'd already been remastered for previous CDs and would have fit easily here. That said, Blowing Up a Storm is a flattering portrait of a band that did a lot of good while trying to do too much.
Kevin Whitehead is currently based in Chicago. He reviewed the new anthology, Woody Herman, Blowing Up a Storm. Coming up, language commentator Jeff Nunberg on how the corporate marketing world is overusing the word solutions. This is Fresh Air. From software to soft ice cream, nobody's selling products anymore. Now it's all solutions. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us what this word says about the new economy.
I got a mail order catalog the other day from a company that specializes in home and healthcare products. At least they used to call them products. But now that word's been entirely eliminated from their catalog in favor of the word solutions. You can find seat cushions in the section on stress relief solutions, bathrobes in spa care solutions, and support bras in intimate apparel solutions. The solutions game began in the early 1980s when companies like IBM started using the word to describe the packages of hardware, software, and services they were selling to corporate customers. In a sense, it's just a new way of pitching your offerings as answers to customers' needs and anxieties, in the time-honored tradition of ring around the collar and the heartbreak of psoriasis. Except that the word solutions makes its point in a proactive way. In the old days, when people said, "I've got a solution for you," you assumed that somebody had mentioned a problem somewhere along the line. Now the two have come unhitched. Solutions aren't solutions for anything anymore. When you do a search on solutions at the website of Compaq or Apple Computer, you find that it's anywhere from 2 to 3 times as frequent as the word problems. Business people don't like to hear talk about problems. It seems to betray a negative mindset. If there are difficulties you absolutely have to mention, you try to find another name for them, as in, "We had a number of challenges this quarter," or "There are several known issues installing the beta release of the printer driver." By now, there are hundreds of firms that have incorporated that word solutions into their company names, and by no means all of them are high-tech. There's the beachware maker Sun Solutions, which is not to be confused with Solar Solutions, which sells propane ranges and composting toilets. And then there's Bright Horizons Family Solutions, an outfit that manages corporate daycare centers, whose portfolio presumably includes story hour solutions and snack solutions, not to mention nap solutions for clients with crankiness issues. It's hard to think of a company that couldn't say it was in the solutions business now. Smucker's, your toast coating solutions provider. And in fact, one reason why so many companies are sticking the word into their names is that they don't have to let on as to what they're actually selling, particularly if they're still in the embarrassing position of making things. Things have low margins and high capital costs. They're expensive to ship. They lead to liability lawsuits. They get you in trouble with the EPA. If you make them domestically, you have to deal with unions. If you make them overseas, people get on your back for running sweatshops. It's no wonder the manufacturing sector is a diminishing part of the American economy. In 1950, material goods made up more than half the GDP. Now they account for less than a quarter of it. And companies that aren't in a position to stop making things altogether can at least relabel them as solutions. It suggests that their products are just an ancillary sideline of their real business, like the terry cloth slippers they throw in when you go for a massage. That's the beauty of solutions. Nobody has to tip their hands. It's a perfect complement for those empty corporate names that marketing consultants paste together out of strings of chopped-up syllables. Take the Ohio outfit called Omnova Solutions. What line of work would you say they're in? Client-server applications, healthcare benefits administration, fabric transfers, and decorative wall coverings? As it happens, it's the last of those, but the others are just as plausible. These aren't like those old-fashioned corporate names that were designed to conjure up an image of a particular product made by a real company. You feel sorry for the members of a softball team who have to take the field with Omnova Solutions written on their uniforms. Names like these are attempts to create pure brands, free signifiers that float in the ether, ready to light on anything that somebody's willing to pay for. That's what the new economy comes down to in the end, just one big intersection with people at every corner holding signs that say, "We'll solve for cash."
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Nonesuch Records, now featuring Joko, the current album by Senegalese world music artist Youssou N'Dour. Available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how George Bush won the overseas vote. We talk with New York Times reporters David Barstow and Don Van Natta about their six-month investigation into the overseas absentee vote count. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.